Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world.
Hello, and welcome to the show, Cybersecurity Where You Are. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO here at the Center for Internet Security, joined by the host with the most, the difference maker, the Hall of Famer, Mr. Tony Sager. Tony, how are you, sir?
Great, Sean. Always good to be back with you.
Fantastic. We're also joined by President and CEO, Mr. John Gilligan. John, how are you?
I'm doing well, Sean. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. Thank you. So we're here, Bonita Springs, Southwest Florida. We're celebrating 25 years of CIS. And I like to, John, I like to say that Tony is our unofficial historian for CIS. And we had your wonderful opening meeting today, where you went through some of the timeline of CIS, where we started, where we've been, and all the challenges that we've faced. So I kind of want to get you both and really start thinking about the history and what's got us here today and what the future looks like. So John, if you could, could you give us how CIS really was started, that idea that initiated what has now become what we know as CIS?
Well, the idea initiated with Alan Powler, and one of our founders, the late founder. And Alan had many ideas. In fact, our co-founder, Frank Reeder, commented frequently. He said, Alan had 1,000 ideas, some of which were actually good. And so this was one of those good ideas, which was that the state of cybersecurity really needed a neutral, independent organization that could operate in a collaborative fashion to be able to identify best practices. And that was really the foundation, and the initial focus was to identify those security settings that would be necessary to make commercial products more secure.
Yeah. I mean, a great idea. And I mean, this is in the 2000s when cybersecurity wasn't even a term for a lot of people, Tony. So when you heard and were part of seeing this evolution necessary of looking at cybersecurity, really trying to bake that in necessarily into our processes, into practices, just really into the software as these are principles that need to be followed. How did you get involved and how did you see that start in the early 2000s from your lens?
Yeah, actually it started this several years before. I would describe like the mid 90s as a real explosion of the internet, you know, in its early days of e-commerce and sharing information, you know, and those were the naive, you know, giddy optimistic days, right? We'll have all this information, we can learn so much, we'll be so smart, we'll make great choices. We never quite got there, as near as I can tell. But we also created, you know, in addition to the amazing good, right, the access, the sharing, we created the greatest engine for criminality and espionage ever in the history of mankind. And that started to become clear in the late 90s. You know, again, this commercialization of all the technology, worldwide connectivity. So I think part of what, I knew Alan, but not very well until maybe 2000. We were seeing government agencies, you know, I worked at the National Security Agency then. We could gather literally room full of people, study the technology, study threats, look at what we were doing to other nations. And we could try to pull together, you know, this is what we think Defense Department agencies should do. And the roots of the NSA security guides, we call them, which is really a sort of a spiritual cousin of the CIS benchmarks, was probably 99, something like that. In-house only, for official use, only for government agencies. And I think one of the things driving Alan was this idea of like, well, what about the rest of us that don't have big teams of people that can't get access to that information? And the brilliance was this, hey, we don't have to each do this alone. We could do this as a collective, right? We could gather the best brain power, but we need an engine or an infrastructure to bring them together that could be seen as independent, you know, that took us to where John mentioned. But my personal connection to this, so it turned out, everyone may have been a little naive. Even NSA didn't have infinite resources and perfect information. And my team leader comes to me, and we had a very successful Windows NT security guide that's well-known within government. And he shows up at my doorstep and said, we're not sure what to do about Windows 2000. NT will be around in the Defense Department for another 10 years, be underestimated by maybe 20 years, I don't know. But what do you want us to do about 2000? We don't have enough people, time, energy. Oh, let's call every government agency that has looked at Windows NT and see if they want to work together. Most of them were gone. In fact, what happens a lot of times in government, right? Get excited, start a program, put out a bag of money. 2 years later, they're on to the next thing. So sustainment, I think, is one of the great ideas, right, that really came with the Center for Internet Security. But I wound up calling this guy that I kind of knew, but not real well, Alan Power. What are you guys going to do in the private sector? He says, I don't know, but we just hired this guy named Clint Kreitner, turned out to be employee number one of the Center for Internet Security. So I called Clint. Partnership, you know, kind of made in the heavens. It was perfect. So that's what brought me in. This, you know, it turned out it was the right answer because, you know, I grew up in a world where you say, well, the government has a different problem than the private sector. Yeah. We're all starting to realize we have a shared problem. Why would we tackle this separately? Again, that was part of, I think, what Alan brought to the table was his vision of collective work.
Yeah. So we have Alan's seed that's been planted now starting to grow. John, when was your first interaction with CIS?
I think it was during the early 2000s. I was at the Air Force as the CIO. I knew Alan Power as a consultant, and also the training that SANS provided was always held in very high regards. And so I invited Alan to be a speaker when we brought the CIOs in. Then I was made aware of the Center for Internet Security, the work that was being done. And I don't know whether we ever contributed anything monetarily, but we were aligned philosophically with the objectives. Then when I retired in 2005, I was shortly after given the opportunity to join the board.
Wonderful, wonderful. So Tony, so John's now on the board. We're starting to see growth. We're starting to see new ideas, new thought leadership come into play. When did you start with CIS and start bringing that thought leadership into the organization?
Yeah, I mean, technically, I joined CIS in January of 2015. You know, and as I mentioned, CIS was a perfect and natural partner for the work that we were doing inside of government. And I sold it to my boss's boss's boss, that under the nonprofit umbrella, they could gather experts that we couldn't hire in the government. Either they're too scarce, they're too expensive, or they wouldn't stay. But we could contribute to the team with the skills that the NSA had, you know, especially cryptography. And so, you know, I'm always a big fan of CIS, saw it as a key partner, helped, was eventually on the, I think it was a government advisory board or something, or there was an advisory board. I forget how exactly it was named, and so participated in that. But I retired in 2012, wound up going to the SANS Institute to work on some special projects, and wound up taking over, you know, a project that we know today as the CIS Critical Security Controls, a volunteer project with a sort of a central hub that was at SANS. And John was a key figure in the origins that led to that. But at some point, Alan and I talked about what would be the future of the controls. And what we decided was, with the support of SANS, we would spin it out into a nonprofit company, which was a tiny little, you know, basically three-person company. The CEO, Dr. Jay Lute, who is still on the board of directors of CIS. And we decided, she met a fellow named Will Pelgrin, which, you know, then the CEO of CIS. And I remember Jane came back from a meeting and she goes, I was talking to Will and we realized we're both heading to the same place. Maybe we should just go there together. What do you think? I said, Will's a great guy. I know that. Makes perfect sense to me. And that was about as, you know, deep as the negotiation got. We had a few meetings in New York to kind of think through the mechanics. But the agreement, January of 2015, you know, just a little over 10 years ago, was the integration of what we call the Council of Cybersecurity into CIS. So that was beautiful because it brought me back to the work of benchmarks, by the way, which was a big part of my group at NSA. I really appreciated what was so exciting. I remember as we drove up in the cab up to the headquarters for the first time, I said, Jane, I get it. You know, I knew this was a good idea, but I could put my finger on it. We have a nationwide 24/7 mission, an operational mission. That is incredibly powerful to be aligned with a professional advice giving mission, right? How to prevent, what are the best practices. And I sort of had, I could piece that together in government. I had blue teams, red teams, people testing the DoD along with the guidance mission. I was so excited that, oh, this is why it made such good sense. So I've, you know, the sort of thinking about how do we get synergy, you know, across sort of operational missions, affecting not only technology and practice, but also policy, the ability to bring all that together. You know, that is, you know, John gave me a challenge a couple of years ago to think about thought leadership and how, you know, what we do is beyond technical, right? We also help change the conditions, the political, social, public policy framework in which we all live, because that allows us to address things like incentives. Why don't people do the things we all know we should do? Well, we don't do that in public health either, right? We don't always eat well. But what are the incentives that would encourage investment in good practice? We can tackle that kind of problem at a CIS. And those are, in effect, you know, it's a bit of a buzzword, but thought leadership problems. It's how people think about the problem and what are the acceptable paths to solutions.
Yeah, wonderful. So John, you're on the board, I believe moved to vice chair and then chairman of the board. In that time frame, what were some of the innovation that was brought in over this time? So you see Tony coming on board, we see now different thought leadership coming in. From the board perspective at that time, was this is just a synergy? This is the way we need to go. This is growth for CIS. Was it just a happy instance that Tony comes back to the benchmarks and Dr. Jane Lute joins the organization with Will? Was that all planned or was this, oh, fantastic. It's everything seems to be aligning. The stars have aligned for us.
Yeah, I think to be fair, there's a lot of serendipity that happened. As I've noted, it wasn't long after I became chair of the board, Frank Reeder had asked if I would take on this role. And at that time, it was CIS, a very small organization. I said, sure, not a problem. We would have, whether we called them board or advisory, I can't recall, meetings. They were more social than they were business-like because it was a kind of an informal organization. But shortly after that, we decided to look at what we called acquisitions, as if we were some big company, we were going to make acquisitions. And that we actually interviewed a number of potential organizations that we could acquire. And the one that made the most sense was the multi-state ISAC. And Will Pelgrin had founded that in New York State government. It just had outgrown New York State. And so, you know, we went about sort of like an acquisition, no cash acquisition. We signed documents and we absorbed the multi-state ISAC. And I think from that moment on, Will brought a discipline, a vision. He was an extraordinarily talented entrepreneur and building relationships and getting more funding from Congress. And the Center for Internet Security went from sort of an informal, nice vision, some good products, to starting to become a real company. We started to develop products. As Tony said, one of the things that did not exist, you know, in any kind of formal way initially was our operational mission. The, you know, starting to deploy sensors and having a security operations center made the company totally different. And so as we continued to mature and as Tony came on board and the controls came into it to now complement the benchmarks. But the state and local support continued to grow. And we got additional funding. We got more products that we were deployed. We began to deploy products that were not funded by the federal government. And so, why did we do that? It's because people asked us. They said, gee, I'd like another Albert sensor, and can I get one? We'd say, I guess we could sell it to you, sure. Likewise, in the 2017 timeframe, we started to formalize what we called sales. And prior to that, the statement off said was, you know, how do people become members of the, you know, get our products? And the answer was, well, they call us and they ask us and we say, okay, you can be. And so what in the, up until 2020 was really a maturing that was, as Frank Reeder once said, he said, up until really 2022 or so, we were just blessed with wonderful opportunities that we took advantage of. And we had really smart people and the company continued to grow and formalize, and we started to have bigger and bigger impact along the way.
Absolutely. It's about relationships. Those identifying those opportunities is a huge, it's not easy. And to take necessarily, we'll call them risks on moving into those opportunities with the, we may not see the complete vision of what we basically were sitting as a company today. I don't know if you imagined, I'll ask you, what we see today is CIS, and now we'll talk about CIS 2.0 moving into the future. Tony, was you, you know, joined the chief evangelist now? How did that look? Was when you joined compared to what you see today, did you ever envision where we are?
My first vision of CIS was the half a dozen people. Yeah. I don't think any two of them lived in the same state, right? They were pioneers and worked from home. And as John said, it was a great idea, but it was by design, a distributed company, right? And this idea of mobilizing volunteers. And I've interviewed a number of the early volunteers. To a person, they say the same thing. Their work as a volunteer for CIS is some of the most satisfying work they have done in this industry. And these are big time people. You know, people are named people in this industry. But that's how I thought of the company. And then so I talked about riding up with a cab to Jane. And I said, hey, give me the overview you'd give any visiting, you know, VIP coming to the company. And the overview was 90% about the MSISAC, which I knew about, but it didn't match my image of the, you know, Clint Kreitner and his merry band of lonely elves. And it was like, wow, this has really grown, you know, and there were probably 75, 80 people at that time when we came in. And, you know, John used a great word, serendipity, right? There wasn't a singular strategic plan or grand vision. At the same time, I don't think of serendipity as a passive thing, right? You just get lucky. You get lucky the harder you look. You get lucky the smarter the people that you have, right? Serendipity gets created by this gathering of smart folks, opportunity, people with, like John, with national level security experience to get a sense for what problems does a nation need solved. All that seemed to come together. But I have to admit, I didn't really, you know, John's been the architect of our incredible growth here in the last several years. And I didn't really see that coming, I have to admit. You know, I knew we would do good work, right? Couldn't help it with the kind of folks that we've hired and the kind of allies that we have and so forth. But this, the ability to craft what I think is one of the most unique business models, certainly in nonprofit cyber technology, is just astounding and off the charts. I mean, we are the envy of most nonprofits, right? We're not driven by grants. We're not driven by someone's political philosophy or a particular tech company, but we really have both the people and the sort of business freedom to pursue what we think are the most important problems for the ecosystem, for the nation. So yeah, I don't know that there was ever a grand vision, but I think it was a series of, you know, good folks, good ideas, good opportunities. Pick the good opportunities and run with them. And, you know, I think it in hindsight, as I look back at the history, I keep going, wow, look at that. Wow.
Yeah.
It's just so amazing.
It's amazing. Now in 2018, a transformational year, John, you joined as president CEO and led us now down this path of phenomenal growth, thought leadership, and really where we are. We've hired some phenomenal people, really doing some innovative things, and we're able to really now contribute. And that's when there was formalization of, as you mentioned, sales, and really starting that we had not only value that we could generate, but value that was revenue driven in the ways that we could do more work in this space and really push cybersecurity to those we'll call the cyber underserved, those that really need the greatest level of protection. And so when you joined, John, and to where we are today, was that your strategic plan? You knew where we would be in 2025 at our silver celebration.
Well, truth be told, the reason that I became the CEO was that I failed in my job as chair of the board. As chair of the board, one of the most important functions of the board is to select the CEO, and I failed. And I mean, it's a much longer story over a beer that most people probably wouldn't be interested in. But the board came to me and said, would you take over as CEO for a period of time, transition period? And I said, sure. And as I got into the organization and got deeper, I began to appreciate more and more what a special organization it is and the potential that we had. And so much the same as just running any business was, let's take advantage of opportunities, let's get the best people we can, let's lean forward in terms of things that we need to build out. So from 2018 till now, you know, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, we didn't have any marketing. We hadn't done advertising. I'll never forget the board meeting we had when we were saying we put $500,000 in the budget for advertising. And Alan Paller just went wild. He goes, what makes you think we need to do advertising? How do you know we're going to get the benefit of that, et cetera? But slowly we began to formalize, more recently we formalized our product development. So we're becoming much more like a very traditional company, which is making us much more powerful, much more influential. So if you trace the history, it's from informal to much more disciplined formal. The caliber of people that we have are just outstanding. But I'd mention one thing, our ability to attract, to retain people and to motivate them is in large measure driven by our mission. People can get their minds around our mission and see the contributions that we are making, which are real and significant. And that goes a long way to helping to attract and motivate a workforce. I think the second, and I really give credit to predecessors of mine, is the culture. We created a culture that is very unique. I've worked in a lot of organizations, but the culture, we have our leadership principles and our way of doing business. And that has made, for me, this is a very special place. And so did I have a vision, perfect vision? No. We took advantage of opportunities. We knew sort of where in general we needed to go. And I would say today we sort of know in general where we want to head. Today we have the luxury, though, of there are far more potential directions that we could head at our choosing than in the past. In the past, as I mentioned, I called it serendipity. Tony called it really wise decision selection. But today we're faced with, there's a number of things we could do that are very impactful and needed. And so this becomes one of our challenges is, okay, which ones do we work on and which ones do we not?
No, absolutely. So now, Tony, we're at the 25-year mark. John challenged us for the next 25 years are going to even be better. So with CIS 2.0, what do you see being some of those opportunities that potentially are very attractive? And there's many opportunities, and it's, which are the right ones for us now and which are the right ones for us to develop into the future?
Yeah, I think for us, there's been a lot of discussion in the leadership team, to try and stay focused on what makes us unique. And that's a tough area to get right, because it's easy to convince yourself that we're great at this or great at that. But for us to sort of, what are the principles, we call them, that are unique about us, right? This independence and this trust. You can declare trust, but trust is a function of how you behave. So we were able to create world-class security content transparently, openly, right? And we play neutral with the vendors. I describe us as independent yet collaborative with the vendors. And both John and I remember the days of combat between buyers and vendors, right? And we've, as an independent nonprofit, through our behavior, right, the way we act, we're not competing with them, but we're in fact empowering them to provide better security in a rational way. So this independence, the trust that we've generated, the unique role that we have as a nonprofit, our ability to be more than self-funded, right, to create value that we can put to causes, things that matter, that don't make any sense for the government to solve. There's not enough economic incentive for the market to pursue. And yet we understand are really important. And we can do that. And who else can marshal that kind of community, those resources, and direct it that way? We're a pretty rare bird. So we focused first on, you know, not losing sight of any of that. And then where does that take us? And I think it's fair to say we feel there will always be a role for this trusted intermediary, right? Who can bring together communities, public sector, private sector, US, non-US, you know, working level, executive level, and guide that community to a consensus and creation of security. So there are a lot of what I call, no knock on anybody's job here, what I call kumbaya gatherings. Let's get everybody together, public, private, and let's swap stories and anecdotes, you know, once a quarter about what we see and what we're going to do and all that. And those are lovely. But that's not content creation. That's not, you know, building the basic tools to defend ourselves. The phrase, I haven't tried this one out on John yet, but we'll see what he says, from conversational to operational. That's what we've been able to do, right? Get past the, let's all talk about this, to how do we turn that into operations, to actual changes in the running environment to make them more secure, more manageable, et cetera. I think we've been able to pull that off. And I do not think that is a common, you know, thing, right? To be able to both recognize it, get the players, create the content that drives it, work with the vendor community, the standards bodies to help put that into the infrastructure. So I think there are always going to be opportunities to there. And I believe in complex social times, and we are in a very complex social time, this role is even more important than it has ever been. We represent a place for safe gathering, to make choices. We know we can cross national borders, sector borders, public and private, and create that. So I think there's a tremendous role for us there. As John said, we have a challenge. We have to translate that into business machinery. We have to create relationships. We have to manage complicated relationships and partnerships. But that's where I see that really is the key for what we are for the next 25.
Absolutely. And with that, we'll be right back after this quick break. Don't know how to meet the standard of reasonable cybersecurity? Well, you won't get there by putting a fancy lock on the server room door.
Right, Sean. CIS Secure Suite comes with integrated tools and resources for implementing a reasonable cyber defense program.
Now, let's not forget about testing. You can also use a CIS Secure Suite membership to evaluate the reasonableness of your cyber defenses using risk quantification.
And this will help you to comply with U.S. and state data privacy laws and show you've implemented the necessary security measures to avoid liability in the event of a data breach.
And now through April 30th, you can save up to 20% on a new membership using promo code RCD25.
So, want to make your cyber defense program reasonable?
Well, you need a CIS Secure Suite membership to build and test it.
Visit cisecurity.org/CIS-SecureSuite to learn more.
Thank you. And let's jump back into the episode. So really the same question to finish off with you, John. The next 25, we've got a lot of opportunities now. We're in the AI space. We're in the countering hybrid threat space now, multidisciplinary areas. Where do you see the next 25 years and opportunities that are exciting you?
Well, I think the current situation, I think Tony's described it well, provides wonderful opportunities. And our current state, I think, gives us an excellent point of departure. So I'll sort of focus maybe a bit in reverse of what Tony discussed. Our relationship with state and local organizations is powerful and unique. And we're only addressing the tip of the iceberg today. And that does not mean that CIS has to be the provider of all of the tools and widgets, but we have the opportunity to influence dramatically the improvement across state and local organizations, critical infrastructure. And I think that's going to be one thrust for us. Now, how that will turn out and what we will field in the way of products and where we'll partner, where we'll influence, I think that's a part. But I think to Tony's point, as a global thought leader, we have now reached a critical mass where we can take on bigger and bigger challenges. To think back, you know, day one was a single benchmark. One product. And now we are writing guidelines where we have products that are implementing our intellectual property and therefore taking that knowledge and institutionalizing it. I think it's almost unlimited what we can do. It's just a matter of, okay, what are the focus areas? And I think we're able to discern what are the things that are most important globally to improving security. You know, the technology's changing. We've, you know, recently moved into what we call this multidimensional or hybrid threats. This is the future. And you know, we've been an early entrant into that. It will change how we work. As you mentioned, artificial intelligence will change the world. And we need to then be able to understand and advise organizations on how to best take advantage, how do you protect yourself in this environment. So they're just wonderful opportunities. And I'm very confident that, you know, we'll get through this current little blip in terms of the funding. And you know, I've heard some people say, you know, this is something that will actually be helpful to us in the future, because our dependence on the federal government was helpful to get us started, but it also became something that held us back. And those that have dealt with the government know that often the government was holding us back. And we weren't able to move as quickly or as decisively. And it'll also force us to be much more sensitive about the value of what we're providing. And I think that'll be healthy long term. So I think it's all positive, and it's only up from here.
Wonderful. Well, that concludes the podcast. And again, thank you so much, John, Tony, your leadership, direction. It's a pleasure to be around and to absorb and try and replicate in some small way. But phenomenal work. Thank you so much. And really, you know, one of the things I also identify is the volunteerism that we have with within the organization as well, that brings their value to what we do for the community at large. But with that, thank you so much, Tony, John. Absolute pleasure. To our audience, thank you so much. Questions, podcasts@cisecurity.org. And with that, we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today.
The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.